Hopefully, I'm now powered by paracetamol. And tonight's talk is how the capitalists came to power, eventually class struggle in medieval England. And I've got three things I really want to get across, which is the rough idea and the difference of what a feudal society was, and the class dynamics that you could find within it, and the kind of like the motifs of revolution. And going back to, I mean, the period I'm going to be talking about is the late 12th to the late 13th century. So well before anything we could recognize as a capitalist revolution in this country, and the eventual real revolution of 1645 or what have you. But there are some very, very recognizable elements to the struggle that they had. And I suppose if there's anything I would want to take away, it is a sense of hope in that, you know, if they were these struggles were going on in the late 12th century, and it took another 400 years, 500 years to really kick in, you know, the fact that we haven't got socialism yet, doesn't mean that it won't happen, and that we have to remember that the class struggle is ongoing. So I always have this trouble when I do history talks. I said this when I did a talk on a roughly similar topic about the birth of capitalism, which actually tends to be picked up this the big changes start happening around the time I'm talking about, which is, you know, you have to start off with, well, once there was a big bang, and everything gets sucked in backwards in history, and try to sort out what's to keep the talk concise. It's always, I think, quite difficult. And I'm going to give credit to, I mean, the awful jumping on a bandwagon of theirs. John Rees and Lindsay German wrote a book, A People's History of London. And I was just flicking through it as I was in the library revising, and I thought, actually, they've managed to cover some of the points that I was struggling to get concise. They've gone, this was happening then. There was a revolt at this point in one sentence and moved on. And it was a nice inspiration to try and keep things simple. One, I don't know how much I need to labour this point, but I want to labour it anyway. Issue that we have, party speakers generally, when talking about contemporary society, we try not to, or we have been told, or it's the culture in the party not to talk about the bourgeoisie, because the modern capitalist class is not the same thing. It's not the synonym for bourgeoisie. The capitalist class is a faction or a fraction of the wider, you know, doctors, lawyers, other types of city dweller from the classical time. And also, the word bourgeois almost exists now in English purely through Marxism and Marxist thinking, and people responding to it and laughing at us or what have you. So it's a bit of an off-putting word, but replacing it is a tricky business. The kind of like Germanic version, burgher or burgess, has a likewise foreign sound to it, and a slightly alien sound. The much better word that was actually used in middle to modern English, of citizen, which does capture the concept very nicely, but unfortunately, it has these strange overtones of the French Revolution, and nowadays this whole business in America and over here about the difference between citizens and non-citizens, and all of this sort of thing. So it's kind of broadened out to be the point of not very useful. So I think that the best way to talk about this is I'm talking about a revolution by the commoners. And I think, even though that has its own problems, the fact that we still have the House of Commons, I think that there's enough semantic grit there to hold on to, that makes it worthwhile. But even then, class distinctions are very fuzzy. And when we're going back to this period, although there might be a temptation at some point in this story to go, "Ah, oh, we're on that side, aren't we?" In some ways, that we the working class didn't have a dog in this fight. Non-existent to any extent that's meaningful, and anyone who looks like they're fighting for democracy in this story usually isn't. They're usually looking out for themselves and a certain privilege within a former society. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about three individuals and I'm going to tell their stories, which will hopefully illustrate the points I'm trying to get across. And keep myself from, because I, as I pick up the history books this afternoon to try and get remind myself what's going on, there's this baffling array of the Duke of wherever and the Earl of what's it place, and someone's in and someone's out, and you know the whole history of the Barons' Wars, which is basically the backdrop to this story. Of the first and second Barons' Wars, and there was the book, I can't remember the author, I could see it just across the room there, which calls The Second Barons' War, The First English Revolution. I don't know how much justice there is in that, but I could see that the point he's making, and I'll come back to why. It's unfortunate that the last character in this story is only called Thomas, because if he was called John Thomas, this would be a story of two Willies and a John Thomas. But as it is, I've only got these two Willies first. So I'll go, actually, one of the first ones, a Bob. So my story goes back to 1220 in Yorkshire. And a character called Robert de Twing, or Twing. And he was a knight of the Shire of that area. And he married Matilda, who was the niece of William de Kilton. And I love the Francophone does. Somewhere in this story, there's a Thomas de Stepney, which tickles me. I don't know quite why it shouldn't. Anyway, so he married this niece and was going to acquire Kilton Castle. Now, Kilton Castle no longer exists, but it's next to Skelton and Wilton. And he was going to inherit the advowson of Kirkleatham. Kirkleatham still exists, St Cuthbert's is still there. But the problem was that the uncle who had the advowson, now the advowson is the right to appoint a parish priest, and this belonged to the aristocracy of the time. Now they didn't have it wasn't a complete right, they were able to nominate, and an advowson was a valuable thing because it represents income and it represents a capacity for patronage, and ultimately it means control of the church and its teachings, and wider social control. And at the time, the great magnates like the Percy family, who owned Northumbria, and the De Bruces, obviously the De Bruce family owned Skelton Castle, which is next door to Kilton. So, of the Robert De Bruce fame, all of these families had castles at the top of North Yorkshire. And they're hoovering up these advowsons if they can get their hands on them. But the problem for Robert is that his uncle on his deathbed, Prior Mark of Gisborough, that's Prior Office Mark, not Primark, they didn't exist, they're not getting involved in this story. Prior Mark of Gisborough got to him on his deathbed and persuaded him to hand over various bits and bobs to the local priory in order to get remittance of his soul. He got better, and this led to eventually he did die, but this led to a long and protracted court case, which seemed to have embittered Robert de Twing against the local church, and he was also very bitter about the legal process, because a lot of this ways that these things were sorted out was through lawfare. And a way that, you know, and this had to go through the ecclesiastical courts rather than through the aristocratic courts. Although he did eventually prevail and got the advowson, and there seems to be records that some of his sons or grandsons ended up as priests in that parish. Because, yes, the way of getting rid of the second son was to put them into the church. that he still retained a distinct antipathy towards the ecclesiastical authorities. And I think it's also worth noting that sometime around this period, John Wycliffe was born in Teesdale. So there's the kind of like anti-clerical attitudes of the Wycliffeites and this sort of thing might have been abroad in the country. And a lot of the sources I can get tell us that he was particularly against the Italian and other foreign priests being parachuted into the various parishes. So there's a bit of nativism going on there. But I mean, I don't know if it could be called proto-nationalism. I think it's more that it's outside his networks of patronage. That's what it seems to me. So he adopted the sobriquet of Will Wither, and him and a band of followers known as the Wither Men started attacking local churches and priories, and allegedly distributed the grain and the wealth that they managed to loot to the poor. Now, again, I'm not sure that they really gave it to the poor, unless they mean poor bandits following a random Yorkshire knight. But that's obviously the part of the propaganda that they're selling. The papal legate was very unhappy, and Cardinal Otto excommunicated him, but the king rehabilitated him, King Henry III, who was very young at this time, and eventually sent him to the Pope to ask for forgiveness. And then he went on crusade and was sent with a message for Emperor Frederick of Germany. And he was connected to the king's brother, it seems, the Duke of Cornwall. Now, I've skirted through. I mean, it's a fairly thin story. But I think it's very useful to me to start with this, because I think this is the start, which is I'm explaining feudalism. So there's various elements I want to pick out. Feudalism is about appropriating movable surplus, not surplus value, but a surplus product, anything that the peasants produce that they don't need to continue living on, that you can walk away with. That's where the wealth is. And that this wealth is moved through, very often through violence, through looting and ransom. But also a chief way is to marry it. And it stays within the family. It's connected in blood. And I suppose it's a useful corrective to think of. In feudal society, so the Duke of Westminster is very rich because he owns central London. That's how it works now, because we have a commodity fetishism. Relations between people become relations between things. In the feudal times, the Duke of Westminster would be wealthy because he's the Duke of Westminster. And the Duke of Westminster, by definition, has to be wealthy. And if he's not, then people have to have an obligation to kind of help him become wealthy. And the other thing is about this is, the note I've got in my talk script or whatever I call it, banditry all the way down. So in his work, Eric Hobsbawm on bandits as a kind of like pre-capitalist mode of resistance, this sort of thing, bandits themselves are, it's the peasants doing it, but it is an expression of this feudal mode of expropriating of surplus. And then what happens if a bandit ends up becoming successful is they become a new aristocracy. So even though some people try and claim that De Twenge is possibly a proto-Robin Hood model, I have my doubts about that very strongly. I mean, that Robin Hood wasn't written down until the 16th century. I think for 15th or 16th century. It's a long time after. The folk memory of the idea of the bandit is just everywhere, and tends to get a degree of popularity. Eventually, he came a cropper because he attacked someone in Westminster. He's clearly a very violent man, and he eventually was rehabilitated. But as far as we know, he disappears from the history books. The only thing to let's see if I can briefly share screen. Oh, hang on, because it's worth showing you the coat of arms, because it's... So let me share. Right, there we go.
Not yet.
So this is... So there you go. That's, I mean, I don't know who'd seen parrots at that time, but there you go. That's the, and this is the coat of arms now of the Lumleys, who are the Dukes of Scarborough. So there's a lineal descent. And of course, as I accidentally came across when I was doing some looking into this a couple of years ago, it seems that he is a lineal ancestor of Joanna Lumley. So there you go. I'm sure you're all thrilled to discover that particular fact. So he's my starting point for this conversation. And you know, the feudalism, the warfare and militarism is part and parcel of the whole get up. And that doesn't just apply to the aristocracy, because I mean it's fair to say that peasants are a martial class in as much as peasants make up the backbone of most of the armies of the time. In reality, in terms of foot soldiers, and of course, for your average peasant, sending a son off to war where there's a chance of loot and glory and all whatnots, and you know, also killing off a few of your surplus peasants as well is part and parcel of the story. Now, I want to jump back a little bit from Will Wither to someone whose name actually was William Fitzosbert. Now, this is a story from the 1190s, and this introduces us to another character alongside William Fitzosbert, which is the Commune of London. And it's worth just spending a little bit of time on the fact that the London was a commune. Now, again, this is one of those words that gets caught up in Marxist discussions as if it's some sort of radical thing. But all it meant was that the people of London had sworn an oath to each other to be a commune and to own their fealty to themselves. They were aware of communes like Paris or some places in Flanders and Italy, where the cities were essentially not under a king. They never quite managed to get that status, but they were clearly animated by the idea of being a commune. So the city itself was ruled by a small number of families who made up the aldermen of the City of London. And the fact that the City of London, even to this day, has this very peculiar constitutional situation where, you know, it sends a member of parliament that's not elected by people, but at least it used to be, you have people there elected by companies in the local government of the City of London, not necessarily by, you know, inhabitants and all of this sort of thing. And it has got some very strange liberties that still probably remain to this day. But they get by because they don't interfere with the life of most of the people. and some of this comes into play. So the issue is, so this guy, William Fitzosbert, he is of a relatively poor family. He seems to be very bright and very articulate. And he possibly was a lawyer or some sort of cleric. Not in the clerk, rather than cleric. He was a functionary within the city. We have records that his brother lent him money, or he gave his money to his brother so that he could go on crusade. And he did go on crusade. He was part of a London contingent going out on the, I think, Fourth Crusade. Let me just double check which crusade it was. I think it's the fourth by now. Third. It's the Third Crusade. So this is 1190. They sailed to Jerusalem. They had a vision of St. Thomas of Canterbury comforting them during a storm. But their ship was commandeered by the townsman for the defence of Silves in Portugal. And he was back home by Michaelmas. So he didn't last very long on crusade. We don't know if he actually even made it to the Holy Land, but certainly he was part and parcel of that movement. And it's just worth, I was double-checking something in a book called Pursuit of the Millennium by a guy called Norman Cohn, which is about, as you can, the clues in the name, millennial sects and revolts in the medieval period. And something, you know, I just picked up this afternoon, he talks about them being in the backlash, the backwash of the Crusades. So there were some Crusades and some points where the people started organizing them themselves and not leaving them to the leaders. And there was clearly some sort of animating idea that transcended the political structures, the idea of Christendom, of the idea that they were all part of something that plays a part and parcel in revolts of the time. And I'm making some tentative, because the present point is, with a lot of these stories, historical sources are very scant. So I have to read between the lines a little bit. You have to forgive me if I'm projecting something onto them. But it seems to me that the story of William FitzOsbert fits in very well with some of the ideas that I came across in the Cone book. So when he comes back, he ends up in a dispute with his brother. And that's one thing that we know. He actually denounces his brother. Because at this time, there's the issue of Richard II has been captured by Emperor Frederick to pay the king's ransom. And this is very unpopular because there's a distinct amount problem of unequal taxation within London and the issue of who has to pay how much towards the tax to pay the ransom and all other taxes. And of course, there is another issue of some of the people who are collecting taxes are not collecting taxes. They're just running a protection racket. So he accused his brother of treasonable words. And he said that his brother had said Londoners would have no king but their mayor. So that's quite a striking thing for his brother to have said, and B, for him to shop his brother on, because I was basically trying to get his brother killed. He says, no two ways about it. So he got a position in the city government, and he ends up as a spokesperson for the middling citizens in the struggle against the rich. And he was known because he sported this great big long beard as he was trying to look respectable or something like that. And he was known as William Longbeard. So that's his nickname. And he didn't actually lead an outright revolt, but by 1196, he's known as the Advocate of the Poor. And he's there on the steps of St. Paul's preaching to large crowds. And now all of the sources I've seen say that he got a following of about 52,000, which, if he had that many actual signed up followers for a political party in 1196 in London, he's got the city behind him. He's got the people, and they were disrupting the business of the commune, which was ruled through an institution called the Hustings. Hence we get the name these days. And a lot of these people were this is, as one source I've seen it, says, this is coming out of the emergence of new markets. As new crafts emerge, as new forms of markets emerge, new groups want to become recognised as guilds within the city, and they're locked out by the previous occupants who don't want to share the power. And I suppose it's useful to point out that we're not far off, obviously, if it's Richard II and that sort of period. We're in the run-up to the First Barons' War. And King John. And London, if I recall correctly, actually in Magna Carta does get some liberties specifically singled out for London. And the aldermen of London consider themselves to be the equals of barons. Whether barons consider them to be equals of barons is a different matter altogether. But certainly the ruling elite think that they are part of the ruling elite. They're in there with the king. But it's interesting to see that this rebel feels that he owes his loyalty to the king. And in fact, at some point, he travels to see Richard. So Richard presumably has been freed, to put the case to him. Now, whether or not he did that, or if he just purported to go see the king, It's interesting that for the outsiders, for the non-elite within London, they still see the king as the saviour, as it were. And that's, I think, very, very interesting. I know, and Cohn in his book, he talks about various false Fredericks and pseudo Baldwins turning up all over Europe. So whenever there's a really serious outbreak of millennial violence, it's usually accompanied by someone claiming to be the true king or the true returned emperor against the falseness of the actual real holders of office at that time. As I suppose that the Papa Tsar kind of thing of be, if only the king knew, if only the king knew about the excesses of his barons. So he's disrupting that. He then gets enough followers, and who is it? The actual authorities decide that they've had enough of him. Hubert Walter, as regent, and with the support of leading citizens, took firm action. When he was summoned, William Longbeard appeared with a mob, and then it gets a bit fuzzy here because the suggestion is in some places that hitmen were sent after him, but he managed to kill them when his mob wasn't around. So, he was clearly handy in a fight as well. But he was driven into St. Mary-le-Bow, where he took sanctuary. Now, again, the records are a bit sparse. Someone set the church on fire. Someone seemed to have violated sanctuary. We don't know whether or not this is William's doing, or the fact is that sanctuary wasn't sanctuary for him, and he was dragged to the gallows at Tyburn, and he was hanged in chains with nine accomplices. And there were apparently people venerated him afterwards as a martyr. And someone reported cures wrought by the chain which had bound him. And certainly, later, a guy called Paris, who seemed to write Matthew Paris, not at the Matthew Paris these days, one of the great chroniclers of medieval England, certainly seemed to feel that he was hard done by, and had a just case. So this has introduced London, and it's introduced the fact that London is riven with political strife. And it's brought in the idea of the Barons' War, and the general issue of the crown. And I suppose to move on to my final part of the story, which is a guy called Thomas FitzThomas. Now, I really, because I'm trying really, I don't, partly because I just can't get my head around the entirety of the Barons' Wars, certainly not the Second Barons' War. But the issue is that it's basically barons challenging the king. And the king is just another, this is why I started with FitzThomas. It's bandits all the way down, bandits all the way up. The king is just another sort of bandit who extracts wealth, movable wealth from the people, and redistributes it to his clients to try and keep them on side. And that's fundamental to the kind of like political superstructure of a monarchy. So when you get there's a problem with his rule. There's issues with the Welsh. There's issues with Crusades, with some sort of fight with the King of Sicily. And one of the ways in which kings were trying to drag themselves up and to rise above the need for the support of their barons, was that they were increasingly getting their hands on money. So one of the things that John had done, and you can see this, I was just looking at the history of the area around Teesside where De Twenge was that you can see that the charters for towns start appearing around about 1190. And charters for markets, and John was one quite expanded the chartering of the creation of towns, because towns equal money. And this is, you can start seeing here how he breaks away from the chains of feudal personal relations and obligations towards the king, which if I might have some points to raise in the discussion afterwards if the discussion falls flat, towards being able to fight. Being able to basically pay mercenaries, and this is one of the drivers for capitalism. Because there's something that happens under Edward I later on is that you start getting clearance of land to get more sheep, to get wool to exchange on the markets, to get more money for the king to tax, because he can then hire mercenaries. So while the Second Baron's War, which has basically very Game of Thrones episode where someone walks into the room with the king without taking his sword off first. And the king knows that the game is up if he doesn't just surrender, which is what he does. And they get something called the Provisions of Oxford, which is almost like a democratic constitution, because it says, well, the king will now be governed by a council, which is made up of barons, obviously. It's not peasants don't get a vote. This is feudalism. It's in capitalism, your vote counts. In feudalism, it's your count that votes. This is part and parcel of the same story, and this is why I'm trying to get across that although that might seem nice and democratic and a way forward, in reality, this is actually quite reactionary in a way. They're holding back the development, and they're just looking after their own interests, which happen to be a smaller version of what the king is doing to them. You pardon me. So the king has been dragged into this sort of arrangement where he is pretending to be bound by the Provisions of Oxford, and you'll never guess what he does next is at some point he says, no, look, I'm the king. You can't tell me what to do ever. As soon as he gets, far enough away from pointy things, to make his safety. But before all that happens, so one of the things that kicks off. So Thomas FitzThomas, he becomes an alderman of London. He's part of the old families. He's thoroughly respectable. But the time he starts to be an alderman, there's a fight going on between the king and the city of London, the Commune of London, largely over tax again. It seems to be a recurring theme. And London maintained that they don't pay a tax to the king, they don't pay tailage, they pay aid. They owe the king a gift. This is semantics, but practical terms, they're standing on their hind legs and asserting their dignity as barons, and they're saying, well, we don't have to pay you this money. We've historically sent you this money, but you don't get to name the price. We have a say in this, and you have to like it. And also there was a big issue that he'd given a charter to Westminster Abbey to have a market at Westminster, which is obviously setting up a challenge to the markets in London. And the Alderman of London said, no, we're not gonna countenance this. So it was an ongoing fight. And what happened was the king managed to dismiss the alderman. He went over the heads to something called the Folk Moot. And the Folk Moot is basically all of the citizens of London coming together. And he said to them, you're going to have to elect juries to try these people for the corruption. And most of the aldermen, eventually, the London caved, partly because it should be mentioned that the king is the biggest customer. One of the reasons why London is so prosperous is because the king is around and they're selling all the wine and all the clothes to keep the court going. And this is one of those kind of things about commoner revolutions versus monarchies, is that the chief source of income is the political overlord that they're trying to bring down. It means they have a very two-sided attitude towards these things. But he's invoked the Folk Moot against the elite. So clearly there's this kind of populism, I suppose, for the king. That's about the 1250s. By 1263, things are getting fairly hairy. There's this ongoing dispute. Simon de Montfort is leading the baronial resistance. The aldermen of London actually sign up to the Provisions of Oxford. They decide that they're going to throw their lot in with de Montfort. And the king has been using London as a base to fight against him. And the citizens of London, the commons of London, decide to take sides. One of the things that triggers serious problems is that at some point, Prince Edward, later Edward I, visits the Temple of the Templars, because the Templars, as a trans-European organization, were a proto-bank. And I love this story, and I'm surprised it's not more well known. And he goes in with some heavily armed friends and say, "I want to inspect my mother's jewels." And he inspects them all of the way out of the bank. And this leads there's this the population of London explodes. And this leads to rioting, this leads to the burning down of Jack Straw's castle. And it also leads, and I'm sorry to do this as almost as a footnote, because but it's such a big topic, it's a talk in itself. It leads to the massacre of 500 Jews, between 70 to 500. The important thing to note is here is this is part and parcel of the same story I've been trying to tell about appropriation of surplus wealth, in as much as the Jews kind of were the property of the king. And as much as they held lots of debts, and the king enforced it on them, and apparently they had to pay the king lots of money to convert. So they didn't just not want to not they didn't they wanted to hold on to their religion and their identity for certain. But even if they decided to convert to Christianity, that meant that the king would lose his Jews. And it's a horrific moment. Now, there is some element, and again, this is that the FitzThomas as the mayor managed to help get some of the Jews of the city into the Tower of London and gave shelter and tried to restore order. But there's clearly another side of this, in as much as very quickly FitzThomas starts to side with the popular elements of the city against the aldermen, and by maintaining on the side of the people. And of course, this leads to massive amounts of looting. But they all swear an oath to each other, to the barons, to de Montfortian cause, and they organise a popular militia which takes over the city. And bypassing the hustings again, FitzThomas appropriates the Folkmoot. So the Folkmoot comes back again, but this time it's by the Mayor of London, and it's used as a tool to keep him in position. But let's always remember that he is not an outsider himself, although he is now enabling outsider groups to come in, cordwainers, saddlers, and all of this, and fishmongers, I think, and new guilds and drapers. This gets to a certain point, though, where the militia that the Londoners have formed go out and they join the Montfortian army. And according to the records I've got, Prince Edward, because there was a point in the story where Queen Eleanor, Henry's wife and Edward's mother, has to take refuge in the tower against the mob of the city, because she was trying to leave and they were saying, "Not a chance." I think somewhere in the book, there's the book by who's the author? His surname's Williams, Gwyn Williams, Medieval London from Commune to Capital, where he says basically that again, FitzThomas has to step in and try and protect the Queen from the mob. So they go out. Edward spies the men of London, and the knights steamroller over these artisans, fishermen, drapers, merchants, what have you. And they lose on the battlefield. That's the long and the short story. Eventually, de Montfort loses, dies in battle. And the baron's cause evaporates, and Henry says, "I'm the king, I'm the king, I'm the king, and I'm staying on side." And then the history Williams book talks about the indiscriminate revenge. Londoners, apparently someone who'd just been to London on a business trip was lynched, because up and down the shires, the name of Londoners was so bad. That any association with London was terrible. But even loyalists to the king found their lands confiscated because he was just well, swathing through and taking as much as he could. And eventually London was rehabilitated by an enormous payment, which again comes back to the whole point for kings. They treat cities as honeypots. And in some ways, a revolt is to be expected from time to time, just like being stung by bees. That's the issue. But while at this point, high feudalism, kings are riding out in armour into battle themselves, and they are the kings of the battle, the main force on the battlefield, because knights are still the business. So that's three stories. So that's eventually, of course, the king moves his business away to other people, but London comes back under Edward I, and eventually starts to be able to elect its own officials and to be able to... be able to start functioning for itself. But it never becomes a commune in its own right, and they never get away from that royal power. So there you go. So that's three stories, which hopefully, as you can see, I mean, anyone who's sort of like watched any movies about the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution, there's certain elements of a king is deposed, the king goes into exile, but still is the king. And although he agrees to be bound by some sort of constitutional arrangement, really he's just plotting and biding his time to come back and restore his personal rule. It's just in this particular occasion, he was strong enough, the opposition were weak enough, and de Montfort was eventually defeated. Although something I'd forgotten until I was revising this afternoon, of course, de Montfort leads to the first parliament in which the boroughs were elected. So representatives of London go to the Parliament, and the Parliament tradition, the House of Commons, which would eventually become the locus of the battle in the 17th century, it kind of starts there. So there's the germ of the idea. That's basically, if you take away it's about patronage, it's about appropriation of surplus, and the difference, I think, between, and I just wanted to draw out the difference between FitzThomas, who is part of a group who are asserting that they are barons, that they are part of the ruling elite and have this aspiration to be the ruling elite, as against someone like Longbeard, whose idea is that they would essentially, as all these millenarial groups, they would wipe the rulers off, and eventually whoever was the charismatic leader would become a new kind of monarch. And I think that's kind of the difference that we can see in FitzThomas as compared to FitzOsbert. I've managed to go on long enough. I thought I was a bit shy of interesting things to tell you. Hopefully you found that interesting. And I don't know how much there is to discuss, but there's a couple of bits I'm sure people might have something to say.